All right. Good morning. Welcome again to PBC. There's a website that I receive regular emails from, one of these things you subscribe to. It's called Quora. If you're familiar with this, it's an online community where people submit kind of random questions. They just ask some question, and then people answer them in various ways, and people vote on which answers they find most helpful. So I was struck recently that this question came across my Quora feed. The question was, why should anyone ever take a job that doesn't pay as much as possible? Of course, I had no personal interest in this question. But nonetheless, I was a little curious as to, you know, how people might answer this question. The most popular answer, the one that was upvoted the most, said this: jobs that pay a lot of money make you feel poor. Person went on to say, I have never felt as poor as I did when I worked at a big investment bank. I made a salary that most people would consider totally insane. The trouble is that so did everyone else on the floor. I had a boss that probably made over $1 million a year, and his boss probably made over $5 million a year, and compared to them, I was a total pauper. I took the subway to work. My boss always took a cab to work. His boss had a chauffeured limo to work. People had better watches than me, they sent their kids to better schools, and they took vacations to more interesting places. Struck me as a really fascinating observation. Jobs that pay a lot of money make you feel poor. And something within that actually resonated with me. You know, we live in one of the richest areas of the world. For me personally, my needs are taken care of. You know, I don't want for things. There's things maybe I could have that I don't, but for the most part, everything I need is there. I eat well and often, sometimes too well. I have a home to live in, I have cars to drive, I have clothes to wear. But driving through this area, I sometimes feel poor. I look around and think, well, that house is nicer, or that car is better, or those clothes are cooler. And so you start to compare yourself to the place you are, and it's easy, even when you have enough, to want more. Why is that the case? Why does money and the desire for money control so much of our lives? Why do we work so hard for it? Why do we sacrifice things for it? Sometimes things we probably ought not sacrifice. How do we break that obsession? How do we train ourselves not to want more, but to be satisfied with what we have and to be generous to others? This morning, we're taking a brief detour from the book of Acts as part of our Sent series. So the way we've designed this series is to have a few times where we kind of verge off onto some topical areas that come up during the course of the book that we want to spend a little more time on. So we talked a month or two ago about faith and politics. Coming up the new year, we'll spend some time talking about race. We'll spend some time talking about world religions. For this morning, we want to talk a little bit about giving, about finances. That comes because last week we saw this story of the mostly Gentile church in Antioch that had really just started. We saw that they were the second church that we've encountered in Acts. We saw the gospel come to them. We saw them develop a community. We saw them learn under Saul and Barnabas for a year. And after only a year, we saw them do something remarkable. They heard about this famine that was about to hit the whole world. And instead of being concerned for themselves, they collected up their money and they sent it back to the church in Jerusalem. So we want to take some time this morning to consider what motivated that community, that new gospel-centered community, to gather up their money and give it away. They had received the gospel from Jerusalem, and then they sent it back in the form of finances. Very quickly, the gospel had changed their attitude towards money. How had that happened? Now, some of the more skeptical among you are thinking, well, how convenient, there's a sermon on giving right in December. That was really well planned, right? Year-end giving. We actually talked a lot about this in the planning and really didn't want to do that. We kind of wanted to avoid that, but in the end, felt like this story in Acts was the best lead-in to this issue, and as we prayed through it, really felt like God was leading us to do this now, not because of the timing, but in spite of it. And that connects because what we're going to discover as we look into the issue of giving is that one of the ways that God has designed giving is not to be for the sake of the recipient. We're going to see that God actually doesn't command us and encourage us to give because there are needs out there that must be met. But God wants us to give because something in our own heart needs to understand what we truly need. We're going to see that the church in Antioch had, they heard about this need, and they collected money to meet this need. But what really happened was that they found a way to put into practice the gospel that they had heard, and in particular, to understand their own need for God. Turns out that giving is a practical and concrete way for us to understand what we really need. We don't give in order to meet the needs of others. We give to discover our own need. What giving does is it breaks us from the power and the obsession of money. Giving allows us to shift our orientation from the material world around us, from the things that drive so much of our time, and reorient ourselves toward God to understand something deep about Him. So let's see how that's the case. To begin, as we talk this morning, I'm going to ask you to pull out your special envelope, all right? If you did not take a bulletin this morning, you picked a wrong week to pass up on the bulletin. Now you may open this envelope carefully. And pull out the gift that we have given you in your envelope. We didn't print these. These are U.S. legal tender, all right? This is not PBC office manufactured. I want to ask you to hold up this gift that we've given you in one hand. And if you can take the little card that we put in your bulletin in your other hand. It's two pieces of paper, right? And yet there's something different about this one, isn't there? What is it that makes this paper feel more valuable than this paper? What is it? Yell out some answers. Why do we care so much more about this piece of paper? You can trade it for stuff, yeah. What else? It fits in your wallet, that's true. You could fold this one, you know, if you wanted to. What else? You get something for it. I heard it has George Washington on it. Yeah, it's a nice picture, right? What else? It says, in God we trust. That's right. Any other thoughts? You can collect it into value, yeah. We're told it's important. Yeah, people tell us that. There's something about this, right? I mean, even just holding money, like something happens to you, right? There's something in your body that connects. There's chemicals going on. I mean, this stuff is like, you know, this card is actually, we spend a lot of time thinking about this. This card speaks of the joy that comes because God came to earth as a man, doing something eternal that changed the world for all of history, for all of eternity. This card speaks of something immensely important. And this can get you maybe a pack of gum, if it's on sale, right? But something happens when we touch this that doesn't when we hold this. Why is that? Money is a powerful thing. It changes something in us. In fact, it turns out that money actually violates a basic economic principle. A little bit of irony there, but most things decrease in value the more you have of them, right? This is kind of like freshman economics, supply and demand. The more you have, the less valuable something is. But actually, a few years ago, the Washington Post ran an article describing a study that was performed at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, a good place to perform this study. And they found that the more money people have, the more they value it. That actually, having more of this stuff makes it worth more to you, which is completely contrary to basic economics. The more money I have, the more I love it. Making this makes me want to make more of it. Having it increases my desire for it. So actually, by coming to church this morning, you have become more materialistic because I have given you money, which has only served to increase your desire for it. So hopefully some other things counteract that. But for most of us, that means, you know, after you got this morning, you didn't say, oh, good, you know, I'd been craving money, but now I'm okay, right? Came to church, and I'm just satisfied. I can go, and my materialism has been satiated, right? Most of us don't feel that this morning. Most of us go, oh, wow, that's kind of nice. More of it would be better, right? That's what happens in our hearts. This is why the Apostle Paul said this in 1 Timothy 6, verse 10. He said, the love of money is a root of all kinds of evils. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs. The craving for money leads people away from God. It leads us into all sorts of dangerous things. Affection turns into love. Love turns into addiction. And addiction turns into idolatry. What ends up happening is we depend on money instead of depending on God. And this is, in fact, what God warned his people about right from the very beginning. Right after God rescued his people out of Egypt, he saved them from slavery. But he told them about something that might happen to them if they weren't careful. Listen to what he said in Deuteronomy 8, 11 through 14. He said, take care lest you forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and his rules and his statutes, which I command you today. Lest when you have eaten and are full, and have built good houses and live in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply, and your silver and gold is multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied, then your heart will be lifted up, and you forget the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. And then down to verse 17, beware lest you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gotten me this wealth. It's a strange kind of process that God is warning his people about. He says, I saved you from slavery, and what might happen is you might obey my commands, and because you obey my commands, you might be prosperous. Stuff in your life might increase, your herds, your flocks, your silver, your gold, everything you have might be prosperous because you obey me. But then the very prosperity that came from obedience might lead you away from me, might cause you to forget that I was actually the source of everything you have. And you might say in your heart, all of this came because of me. Now, today, God doesn't reward obedience with prosperity. Things have changed since Jesus came. But the same principle applies, where prosperity, when things are going well in our lives, those things can tend to draw us away from God. We can tend to think that things in our lives are going well because we made them go well. And we can forget about God. It's one of the reasons why people in this area have such a hard time coming to faith. Who needs a savior when there's nothing to be saved from? Think about your life. Are you tempted in this way at all? This room is full of people I know who have tried hard to be faithful and obedient to God. This room is also full of a fair amount of prosperity. Have we allowed that prosperity to convince us that it's our efforts, to convince us that we did it, that it came from ourselves? Have we said it's because of my power and the might of my hand that I have what I have? Are we addicted to money? Even just a little bit of addiction. Are you addicted to money? I really love blueberry muffins. I love the muffin part of the blueberry muffin. I love the blueberry part. And I love that part right around the blueberry that doesn't quite get cooked all the way. You know what I'm talking about? It's a little bit soft. I love blueberry muffins. The crumbles on top. So one of the things we do sometimes as a family is we buy those store-bought boxes where you can just, you know, 5 minutes and you put them in the oven and you have blueberry muffins. But here's the thing about those blueberry muffins. I'll eat one and I'll think, that was great. Another one would be better. And I'll have a second. And then I'll have a third. And I just want a fourth after the third. And after the fourth, I want a fifth. And I think about, there's some animal, isn't there, that will literally eat itself to death. And I think that's kind of the way it is with blueberry muffins. Because those kinds of muffins, they put some chemical in them. I don't know what they do, but it makes you want more. And that's kind of the way money is for us. Having some only increases our appetite so that we think more would always be better. One of the reasons we love money so much is that it gives us power. It opens up possibilities. That was one of the things people said. With it, you can do something. I could make a decision. With this dollar bill, I could buy any number of things. I have power now to do something, and this gives me independence. It gives me control over my life. And we like that feeling. We like to feel like I can do what I want to do. And it starts to seep into our souls, and we start to crave that autonomy, that control more and more, and we start to think that I can actually do it. And we forget about our dependence on God. We become addicted to our own control. The problem with that process is not that the church will have to close its doors, or we won't be able to finish our remodel project, or our salaries won't get paid. The problem with that whole process is what's happening in our hearts. The problem is that we are turning away from God when that happens. God doesn't need your money. God's got plenty of money. God needs you to know that you don't need your money. The problem is what's happening inside. So what do we do then? What do we do with this addictive nature of ours? Well, you got to understand addiction. You got to read books on how addiction happens. You got to search your own heart to fully grasp the nature of your own idolatry. You have to spend years in therapy to really untangle all the things that got you to where you are. Except all that's not true. It's actually very simple. The solution to this problem of addiction is not an intellectual exercise. It's not dependent on your skill. It's not even dependent on how much money you have. Jesus encountered a man who was desperately addicted to money. He was young, he was successful, he was powerful. But there's some part of him that wanted to follow God. And so he came up to Jesus and he asked him, "How can I do that?" This is what Jesus told him in Mark 10, verse 21. Jesus, looking at him, loved him and said to him, "You lack one thing. Go, sell all that you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come and follow me." It's simple. It's absurdly simple. One way to break your addiction to money is to give it away. That's it. Give it away. The way to break your addiction to money is to give it away. So if you find yourself in your heart clinging to that sense of control and independence, addicted to money, give it away. Now don't be deceived. Being simple doesn't make it easy. That young man that Jesus gave such a simple solution to, he walked away sad. He walked away because he found he didn't want to give it away. He didn't want to do this. That addiction had so controlled his heart that it was too much to ask. There's a scene in the first Lord of the Rings movie, if you're familiar with this, where the hobbit Bilbo has his ring, the special ring, And he wants to give this ring to Frodo. And so he makes all these plans. He devises this incredibly elaborate event. In order to give this ring away, he puts an envelope not too dissimilar from this envelope that he's going to use to give the ring to Frodo. And he does it, and he seals it, and he puts it on the mantle. And then his mentor Gandalf says, "Bilbo, where's the ring?" And he says, "Oh, it's in my pocket." He wants to give it away. He's planning to give it away. He's thinking about giving it away. But in the end, it's hard. He fails to do so. Throughout the scriptures, there are many practical suggestions for how this happens. People know, the authors of the scriptures know, that this is a process for us to learn. And so the Apostle Paul and others write several things. So I want to suggest three practical solutions for this challenge, for the fact that we have a hard time when it actually comes to the step of giving it away. The first suggestion is to plan ahead. Plan ahead. In 2 Corinthians, Paul writes to a young church and commends them for wanting to give their money away. He says, "I know that you've made plans. I know that you've talked about this," but he warns them, don't let it just be talk. Go ahead and do what you've planned to do. And he tells them that he's going to come to receive their collection, but he gives them some advice about what to do before that. 2 Corinthians 9, verse 5, he says this, "So I thought it necessary to urge the brothers to go on ahead to you and arrange in advance for the gift you have promised, so that it may be ready as a willing gift, not as an exaction." See, he wants them to set aside the gift, to prepare it in advance, to plan to give it away, so that when he comes, they can just give it willingly. So that when he comes, it's not the, "Oh yeah, we said that. Boy, where are we going to find the money to give you?" You don't have to go through that. When Paul comes to receive it, it's just a celebration. We learned about this principle as a family when I was in seminary, and it has been probably the single biggest thing for us that has made giving way more fun than it used to be. So what we do is we have a separate bank account we actually use for all of our giving. And every month we transfer some money into that. And once money goes into there, it's like gone into a black hole. Like that's God's black hole. And nothing can touch it. And once it's there, it's been given. And then from there, we can give out to various needs. And we kind of have monthly things that we give from there. But we give into it a little more than we promise monthly. So it kind of accumulates. And the fun thing about that then is you have this money waiting to see how God might want you to use it. And in my mind, what it does is it separates the pain of giving, the sacrifice. You do that part, and then later you get the joy of saying, "Oh, you're going on this mission trip," or, "Oh, you're doing this thing," or, "Oh, there's a crisis," or, "Hey, this money's been set aside waiting exactly for you, and you can release it to them." I think that's what Paul is saying here, so that this gift can be given willingly, not an exaction, not something that is muscled through, but the celebration of being able to provide for someone else's need. So plan to give, plan ahead. Secondly, set a goal. Have some goal that you're trying to attain in your giving. Now, people talk a lot about 10% as the tithe, and there's this kind of this perception that the Old Testament recommends 10% as the giving amount. In reality, though, if you look at the Old Testament, the amount of the tithe in the Old Testament was actually closer to 23% than 10%. This is a little-known fact and very fondly forgotten fact. But there are actually two tithes of 10% that were taken every year. One is commanded in Leviticus 27 for the sake of the priests, and one is commanded in Deuteronomy 14 to be set aside for worship festivals. And so there were these two things taken every year, and then there was a third 10% tithe that was collected every 3 years for the sake of orphans and widows and Levites, kind of the people on the margins of their society. So if you kind of average that out, it comes out to about 23% a year. Now that was also, of course, for them, their governmental system, so it's a little hard to make exact comparisons for us. But I think what's helpful for us is that they had a goal. And 10% is a good place to start. For some people, 10% is too much. It's unattainable.